Oh, look at those questions. just happened to have.
I've got some questions with answers.
I've got some questions with the answers all written out. Well, this part we'll just keep off the record.
I'm going to get my gas out of here.
Oh, you do?
I hope you have more. Hope you have more success with that than the one I use. Oh, thank you. Just take one. Thank you very
much. Now we've got 3 hours in Hainan. How much time?
I know you feel that I'll go that long.
How much time?
What is it, Ted? What's our about? What time do we have to leave here? 6 o'clock. About 6 o'clock. Now that's, oh, you've got one of those nice clocks there that really works. That gives us an hour and a half.
Oh, that's great.
An hour and 15 minutes or something like that. What time? That's right. Oh, yes, that's right. I got to go to a place where I may get a few votes. Down to the...
Well, you may get some votes here.
I'm going to work on it.
Give us the right answer.
National newspaper publishers.
I tell you what,
the Negro newspaper publishers.
Yes, Negro newspaper publishers are in the city, and I hope to get over to them just a while. No, I'm not. I'm going to do that on the way coming back from Minnesota this weekend. I've got to go out there.
If you stick to the 1 minute rule, you get some votes here.
Well, let's just forget it. Give up. Well, fine. Let's
go, huh?
Fine.
And then, if you want to go off the record, you shout. Huh?
Yes, sir.
All right. What we want to do is hit Vietnam, the campaign, Lyndon Johnson.
Or not.
And one or two.
All right, fine. All that electronic device working back there. Is
everything on? Okay. Mr. Vice President, you're emphasizing now that from the start you wanted a political solution to the war. Yet we have the impression that you supported all the attempts at a military solution, the bombing, the escalation, and so on. Is that impression correct?
Well, my comments and observations about the struggle in Southeast Asia and in Vietnam in particular did not start in 1965 or 1964. I addressed myself to these matters and particularly to Vietnam as early as 54 up through 64 in several of the discussions in the Senate. As I recollect, there was even one interview that I had with one of your correspondents here in either August or September of 1964. In all of those, and I have checked them back rather carefully, I emphasized the importance of our trying to, first of all, strengthen the political and economic and social structure of South Vietnam, recognizing in that time the limitations of the Diem government. I also recognize that with the increase in the inflow of North Vietnamese regulars, and particularly with the association of Hanoi with the Viet Cong, which was revealed as being clear and explicit in 1959, late 59 or early 60, that it was necessary for the United States to extend first military assistance as well as economic assistance to South Vietnam. I supported the efforts that were made by President Eisenhower and President Kennedy in the military advisors and the special forces. And I did support decision of the cabinet and, of course, of the president. He makes the ultimate decision to send in air power in February of 1965, and then in July of 1965 to augment the ground forces. Now, all of these efforts, which I did support, were not conceived in the belief that the solution to the Vietnamese crisis and the deterioration of the situation in Southeast Asia was a military solution. The military was there as a holding action in the hopes that, or in the hope that, we could find a political solution. I believe it's fair to say that no one really contemplated the depth of our involvement. Maybe this is one of the lessons that we need to learn out of Vietnam, and I think there are several lessons that we will learn from this tragic struggle. The input of military forces was, of course, matched by the increased infiltration of North Vietnamese regulars and the recruitment of the Viet Cong in the south. When additional military forces were asked for from the United States, that decision was made by the Commander-in-Chief, the President. I know that he consulted his military advisors and the National Security Council, but not on every increment. On the major ones, there was discussion. For example, on the last one, when there was requests from the military, or if not requests, at least advisories from the military, that there were substantial numbers of new troops required, the President discussed that matter at length with his advisors and came to the conclusion that we should not send large numbers of new troops, nor should we call up the reserves or the guard, but rather that there should be a selective call-up of some limited number of reserves and a very modest increment of troops, only in of support troops. Now, I was one of those that supported that decision, the decision namely to keep the number very low, feeling that somewhere along the line we had to hopefully find a maximum of involvement militarily, or at least to try to curb our involvement militarily without jeopardizing our investment of men and resources that had already been made in Vietnam. To summarize it, it has always been my view that our purpose in Vietnam was to find a way to bring this conflict to the conference table. We may have been ill-advised, or maybe we made poor decisions in the minds of some people we did. But neither the President nor the Vice President ever believed that the struggle in South Vietnam was going to be settled by a military solution, that the military was a part of the mix that would be required to bring about a political solution, a negotiated settlement. I believe that I have supporting evidence to this observation by the emphasis that we placed upon elections, the emphasis that we placed upon pacification. Pacification which all too often was not successful, but where we made repeated attempts to revive and revitalize and improve the pacification effort. The emphasis that we placed upon curbing inflation, the economic emphasis, in other words, that this government placed in our Vietnamese policy. Had we been seeking a military solution to Vietnam, we would have had to involve ourselves much more deeply in manpower and resources. We would have had to yield to the pleadings of some that there be an invasion of the North and carry the military battle to the North. We would have run what I think were grave risks of a major confrontation that could have involved us in a war far beyond the present situation, and maybe a war with the major powers, particularly the Soviet Union or Communist China. Every military step that we've taken has been measured very, very carefully as to its political effect and as to whether or not it would be responsive to the ultimate objective of political settlement. I recall Mr. McNamara, for example, in his, and he can speak for himself, but if he would, you might want to check this with him. But I recall on many occasions, at least several occasions, how the discussion of troops, when the discussion of troops would take place, or more manpower or more air power for Vietnam, the effect that that would have in terms of our overall international policy, our relationships with the Soviet Union, the possibilities of aggravating the situation with Communist China, and whether or not this was really lending itself to the self-determination of the political institutions of South Vietnam, the growth of those institutions, the self-reliance of the South Vietnamese people upon them, their own self-reliance, and whether or not it would lend itself ultimately, that is, an increased military effort, to getting North Vietnam to that conference table. Now, gentlemen, it is my considered judgment that we have made sincere and at times pleading efforts to bring this conference, this confrontation in Vietnam, this struggle to the conference table. I won't go around and list, I don't need to list all the efforts that we say we've made. You know the ones that we've made. We think we've made many of them. I know that we have. I know that we've tried to encourage the political solution of this struggle through the UN, through third parties, through the Soviet Union, through the good offices of the Pope. Through the non-aligned nations. I can even recall ministers of other countries coming to visit me without trying to involve them as individual countries, but a vice president of a particular country, a foreign minister of another country, hopefully using their good office to bring about a political solution. So the answer to this prolonged answer to this very detailed and very difficult question, Scotty, I have supported a political solution. I have not, however, felt that a political solution in this situation was possible without at least a show of strength to prevent the tide of aggression which made it impossible for any kind of equitable political settlement. Now, I must say that I'm of the opinion that our government, and indeed our people, because our government in a sense reflects our people, we are not very expert as yet in what I call the politics of struggle or the politics of war, the geopolitics of it. We have as a people really not fully understood what we mean by counterinsurgency. We have not really fully understood the psychological warfare. I believe that as a people, as well as a government, we have a great deal to learn about this. And I hope that out of Vietnam we will learn that you have to make some very positive efforts before you become involved militarily in the hopes that you won't become involved. I can't say that there will never be another situation where American power may be called upon. I can't say that. I do think, however, that the world situation today surely indicates to us that that power has many faces. And that when you use the word power, you're not just talking of military power. You're talking of your diplomacy, your economic power, your economic strength, to use a more sanguine word. You're talking of psychological forces that are at work. And I hope that we will learn how to develop, as I said recently, not only sophisticated weapons systems, as the Defense Department talks about it, but more importantly, sophisticated political weaponry. The political armament or the political systems that are required to win political struggles, because we're going to be confronted for the rest of our lives, as far as my life is concerned, I'm sure, with an unstable world, with a world of peril and danger and uncertainty, with subversion and guerrilla warfare as a part of the pattern. Now, we surely don't want to go around trying to be required to put out every brush fire. We do not want to be the world's policeman. I think really what we ought to try to prepare ourselves to be is a in a very real sense, a political advisor and a political scientist that understands the forces that are at work in this world.
But, Mr. Vice President, yesterday, as I understood what you were saying at the press club, you were saying, and I think this is roughly your own words, that we must protect the right of peoples against violence. But you may draw no distinction between the areas vital to the security of the country and the other areas, or whether there's collective security and aid from other countries. So doesn't this really come down to an offer to continue the old policy of military intervention?
In the time that one had yesterday, he didn't have the opportunity to review the whole dimension of American policy or the world in which we live. First of all, we have no obligation to protect everybody from violence. That surely is not one of our obligations. We have some treaties where if there is external aggression, that we have at least the obligation to use our constitutional processes to fulfill the responsibilities that we've taken on under those treaties. But I do not think that we should ever get ourselves into the position of saying that wherever there is violence or trouble in the world, that American forces must rush pell-mell. To the contrary, we need to examine what are our priorities, both in terms of the utilization of our resources at home as well as abroad. This world that we're talking about is not the world of 1948, and that foreign policy of 48 is not applicable to the world of 68.
Do you fulfill your commitments under treaties regardless of whether the other signatories fulfill theirs?
I believe that we must take into consideration what other signatories do, but I believe that as a major power, we must at least attempt to set an example or to give leadership. I believe that we ought to learn a very good lesson out of some of our involvement today, namely that when you make treaties, you better be very sure that the treaties that you're making are the ones that, insofar as your vision is able to direct you, that those treaties are related to your vital interests, to your national security and to your vital interests. I think it is a danger not to fulfill your obligations once that you've taken them. I guess maybe I'm the victim of some experience. It is my view that the tragic experience of the 30s, where people did not live up to their treaty obligations, precipitated the crisis, at least helped precipitate the crisis that became World War II. I do not believe that we ought to go without learning. I do not believe that that experience ought to leave us without some impression as to the danger of committing yourself on the one hand and the failure to fulfill on the other. But let's make it very clear. The duty of the President of the United States is to the best of his ability, to protect the vital interests of the American people. Now, those vital interests may be protected at times by being deeply concerned about the interests of other people in an interdependent world. No president has divine wisdom. He must gain his information from mortals, and hopefully out of that information to be able to make appropriate and responsible judgments. And I want to be very clear. I do not see the role of America as the policeman of the world. But I want to be equally clear that the failure, or the failure at times to use power, when such power might be required, influences events in the world as well as the using of said power.
Sir, in this connection, sir, there are a number of people who are friendly to the administration's policies in general, including a number of foreigners, who say that one of the worst results of the war in Vietnam has been that it has reduced our ability to respond to our obligations such as those you outlined. In other words, that our involvement has been so deep, that the effect of has been so divisive in the United States, that we would be slower to fulfill our obligations, and thus many countries abroad might be more timorous about their own actions or relations with our potential enemies. Could you respond to that?
I've heard that, but I must say that I am not always, I'm not really convinced by the validity of that rather subjective judgment. Let me just go back a minute here. We're talking about the past now. Let's talk about where we are now and where we're going. The politics and the policies of the late 40s and the early 50s are not relevant to the world of the late 60s and the next decade or generation. When I came to the United States Senate, the main argument that was taking place at that time was the Marshall Plan and our fulfillment of its our obligations under it, and then subsequently NATO. We saw a what they called then a communist monolith with its head in Moscow, a tight police state system spread across Eastern Europe, which Mr. Churchill characterized as being the Iron Curtain. Interestingly enough, in the 50s, that situation was shattered just as much as our own social structure was shattered. America, during that same period of the late 40s, had a system of segregation in certain parts of America and a partially open society in other parts of America. In 1954, Brown versus the United States, the Supreme Court struck a body blow at segregation in our public education structure. With the death of Joseph Stalin and the subsequent rise after an interim period of Mr. Khrushchev, with Mr. Khrushchev trying to justify his claim to power and indeed making some of the changes that needed to come, as he saw them anyway, in the Soviet structure, the monolith of communism began to be shattered. In fact, its first crack was Yugoslavia. That was temporarily contained, so to speak. And then came Mr. Khrushchev, who opened up just a little bit to show that his policy was different from Stalin, that Iron Curtain. And the breath of creativity and innovation and at least of some sense of emancipation and liberalization flushed under that Iron Curtain. And since that day, Eastern Europe has never been the same. From the day that Harry Truman's rights to secure these rights, the report on the civil rights of America, the effort that was made, and I was a part of it in the Democratic Party in 1948, Brown versus the United States in 1954, the rise of this country of the civil rights movement. Since that day, the United States has been different. We've had a changed society, and with its turbulence and with its anxieties, so has the communist society had its turbulence and its anxieties. It's a whole new ball game, to put it bluntly, at home and abroad. And the old remedies that used to apply in America under the days of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman to our needs are not quite relevant to the needs of today. It isn't just enough today to have more Social Security. It isn't just enough today to have more unemployment compensation. That is not satisfying the deprived and the disinherited of America. They want a piece of the action. They want involvement. They want to be a part of it, as I said. They want to be a part of the decision-making process. They want to be a part of the social structure. They want to be have a part of the benefits. They're not satisfied with Social Security. They want social opportunity. That's what they're talking about here at home. And therefore, any old-time New Dealer that feels that all you need to do is to dish up more of the goodies of life to satisfy the young militant today, or to satisfy the inhabitant of the ghetto, has failed to see what's happening. There is a desire for personal identity today, more than anything else. A an almost an it's an ugly, it's an angry desire for it. That's really what you're seeing. That's part of the protest that you see on the college campus. It gets out of hand, like most protests do. That's part of the protest you're seeing in the inner cities. It sometimes gets out of hand. This desire of the individual to be for his own personal identity. This is happening behind the Iron Curtain. First, in nation states, the socialist states want to be known in their own, in a sense, in their own national way, with their own national culture, even though they have a common interest in terms of what we call the socialist communist ideology. And then the individuals in those socialist states and communist states are different. The young man and woman in Czechoslovakia today, to him, the revolutionary is like cowboys and Indians to the kid today that's looking at the television. There's hardly a dozen of the original, there's less than 100 of the original revolutionists left in the Soviet Union. And the young people of the Soviet Union today think of those people as being way in their past, just as our young people today think of many of the early Americans as being far removed from many of the realities of our time. Now, I say all of this because to fashion a policy, domestic or foreign, on the basis of a depression epoch, or on the basis of an immediate post-war epoch, is, I think, futile. And not only that, I think it just refuses to recognize the realities of our time.
But what's the answer to this question?
I thought I'd given it.
No, he suggested that as a result of intervention, we were weaker.
I said that I thought that was a subjective judgment to which I did not agree.
Could I put then the question to you in another way? When this administration came to power in 60, one of your main arguments was that the Eisenhower years had reduced the prestige of this country. What is your impression of where the prestige of this country is in the world today as compared to 60?
Well, prestige is somewhat related to the views that others have of themselves, as well as the views they have of you. For example, in my visit to Western Europe within the past year, about a year, a little over a year ago, I found a Western Europe that was vigorous, competitive, self-conscious, nationalistic in terms of Europeanization as well as their respective countries, really almost unmindful, the younger generation, that the United States had had anything to do for them or with them. And some people are of the opinion that that's just too bad, that it shows that they're ingrates, and that Europe doesn't like America. That doesn't show that at all. What it shows is that Europe's wounds of World War II have in a large measure been healed, that they have come back to a kind of competitive normalcy where they feel that they're equals, that they do not want to be treated as if they are poor country cousins. They have a sense of pride, of independence that almost borders at times on arrogance. But to me, I'd rather have that kind of a Europe that could at times sneer at us rather than a Europe that constantly came to us like a supplicant and a relief client. Now, I haven't any doubt but what the struggle in Vietnam has engendered a great deal of animosity amongst certain people in the European community and in the Asian community, not nearly as much in Africa or in Latin America, but in certain areas of Asia and, of course, in the Western European community. Part of that is due to very effective propaganda against us. Part of it is also due to a feeling that our policy is just wrong. People have a right to their point of view. But insofar as our prestige is concerned, if the elements of prestige relate to your economic strength, your military strength, your position in this world, I believe that there is still a respect, and a great respect for America. For example, I notice that when nations get in trouble in the Middle East, they're perfectly willing to ask us for their help. And I noticed even senators that couldn't see any justification for our help in Southeast Asia were perfectly willing to load up every member of our armed forces and ship them to the Middle East. They weren't pacifists, they were just selecting which war they wanted to fight, which is a man's privilege in this country. I happen to have a deep interest myself in the Middle East. I think it's no secret here. I'm not saying this to please any ethnic or religious group in America. I have maybe taken a greater interest in the viability and the safety and the independence of the State of Israel than almost any member of the United States Senate over the years. And I did so before I came to the Senate. I happen to think it's very important that that country survives as a free and independent nation. I think that that country has a great respect for our prestige, or we have prestige in that country. I notice as of late, with the Berlin crisis, that our allies again seem to be a little bit more interested in the United States. When they get in a little trouble, then they have a greater regard for us, and our prestige seems to have a kind of an upward trend. But I would not want to minimize the antagonism that has been evident in many of the areas of the world because of our involvement in Vietnam, and that's why another one of the reasons that I feel that we must press relentlessly for a political solution to this war. And a political solution requires adjustments, it requires negotiation, and I don't know what that solution will be, and I don't think it'll help gain it by the Vice President of the United States venturing forth with his little private proposals as to how we ought to obtain it. I really believe what we can say now is that no matter the torturous route that we have followed, whether you've agreed with it or not, at least we have arrived at one of the way stations that points to some hope, namely the conference table at Paris. I'm not so foolish or so... I'm an optimistic man in the main, but I'm not so optimistic as to think that this will lend itself to a sudden and quick resolution of the conflict. But I do think that if we stick with it, if we don't take any rash action, which I'm sure we won't, that there's a good chance that with the patience and perseverance that we can... that we can make progress towards a peaceful settlement.
Mr. Vice President, you, in talking about the events of the Vietnam conflict, you mentioned that you had supported the decision to extend the aerial warfare, the bombing, to the
yes.
North in January 65, and the introduction of troops in July of 65.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if we were to imply that you did not support the decision to bomb Hanoi and Haiphong.
I don't think that it would be very helpful for me to discuss each and every little discussion that took place around the cabinet table, Mr. Salisbury, and I don't try to evade your question. I only put it this way. I have never been told what to say by the President. I have never cleared a speech with the White House. Some of my staff members on occasion have called up the State Department to see whether or not I was getting too far out on something, but the President said to the Cabinet that he did not want the Vice President to be called upon to clear any speeches. He relied upon my judgment. At times, I imagine I caused him some concern because I have my own views, and there were times that some things were said that could be interpreted in a way that might not be as helpful to the policy of our country as he would have liked it at the moment. But very seldom did that happen. I spoke freely. I gave my voice into the mix that makes up what you call advisory opinions. Sometimes my advice maybe wasn't very well grounded because I had a limited perspective on the picture. Sometimes maybe it was well grounded. Sometimes the advice that I had found its way into what, without my making the policy, what became policy. But I'm happy to tell you that I wasn't alone in this. There was never a yes man's National Security Council. And most of the great decisions that have been made by this government and by the President have been made after the President's own way of consultation with his advisors. Frequently, that advice was very private, with one man at the time or two men at the time. The President's closest advisors have been the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. He has also called in private advisors, as you men here know. to be president and to seek advice. There's all kinds of advice available, but to seek the advice that has experience involved in it as well as just emotion is a great challenge to the president. I think it should be answered. I must say to you in all candor that there have been times that my views have been different from those of other members of the cabinet. And there have been times that my views have been in concert with what ultimately took place most of the time. There have been times that my views did not.
Mr. Vice President, on that point, are you saying then that to the extent that you have been identified with the policies of the Johnson administration, you've done so freely and openly, and you have no wish to dissociate yourself from that?
That is correct, sir. I can't say that everything that we have done is exactly as I would have done it. I made my point yesterday. I was a member of the team, not the captain. I was not calling the signals. I was in the position of a lineman doing some of the downfield blocking. It's a great deal of difference, but I make no apology for it. You can't always have it your way. I do know this, that if there's a new administration and I'm in charge of it, the policies will be Humphrey's policies, President Humphrey's policies, as he is able to present them after proper discussion and consultation and the evolution of those policies.
Aren't you going to have to do that before you get to the point, before you get into the White House?
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about that. One will lay out his own program. The Democratic Party will lay out a platform, for example. Besides that, the Vice President of the United States is a candidate, if I'm permitted to have this nomination, and even before, will lay out his views on a number of issues. But let me say that many of the things that we have done as a government have been done only in part. There's, for example, just this very simple thing. Our water pollution control program is not wrong, and you don't really have to be a great innovator to get a better program. You need more money. We've got a good water pollution program. And when I met with the mayors of the cities and villages of the United States, the number one thing that the mayors asked for, almost without exception, over 90% of them, were funds to improve their sanitation system, their water supply system, their sewage disposal system. Now, gentlemen, I don't have to be a great innovator of change to make a dramatic improvement in the health and the well-being of people who live in cities. All I need to do is to be able to get the money from the Congress of the United States.
Which means getting an end to the war, doesn't
it? It means many things. It means being able to find the revenues out of the taxing power of the Congress from the American people. It means being able to cut back on items which are less important. It means hopefully to be able to find peace. But I want to say in all candor, I was in Congress, and you've heard me say it before, in 1954. And you were at this table, some of you, in 1954. The war was over in Korea. The cities had slums. The rate of illiteracy was much higher than it is today. The number of the people impoverished was larger percentage-wise and in aggregate number than today. And there was no war on poverty. There was no federal aid to education. There was no water pollution control program. There was no consumer protection legislation. There just wasn't. So it wasn't peace that made the impact on America. What happened was they reduced taxes and cut expenditures. Now, I think the important thing is this war is going to be over. And I pray to God it will be over early. In fact, I think the greatest thing that could happen today is a ceasefire. And I would hope that we could pick up that call, not only in the councils of this government, our government, but all around the world, calling for an end to the hostilities, an end to the killing, as we seek to find a way to an honorable, peaceful settlement. There hasn't been much talk lately about a ceasefire. We've almost become accustomed as individuals and public officials through the enemy calls fight and talk. I suggest that we talk. You bet we are. We're prepared for a ceasefire any hour of the day. And it seems to me that this is one of the basic essentials of a successful negotiation. However, Hanoi has shown no such interest. But it may. I think we ought to keep pounding away at it. But let us go back to Scotty's question again. If the war is over, what will be done with the resources that are saved, if you please? Do you have any assurance that those resources will be directed towards our cities? I hope so. I'm going to lead to the best of my ability for that accomplishment, for that purpose. I did so in the 50s. I fought hard for it.
With respect to that amendment, would it be your purpose then to suggest that as our responsibilities in Vietnam are reduced, that we commit dollar for dollar the release money to the relief of the cities?
Yes, let me direct my attention to your question. We're at Paris. Secretary Clifford yesterday gave us some indication that whatever little movement there has been positive. Now, that's his evaluation. I believe that is the consensus of our top government officials, that at least there is some indication that there is a more responsible dialogue in Paris on the subject of this war than there was a week ago, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. While we're there in Paris, we are at the same time making continued efforts and much more accelerated efforts to make the Arvin a more effective defense force so that the South Vietnamese can take on their own responsibilities more and more for their own defense. While we have been in Paris, we have used our good offices to broaden the base, to encourage the broadening of the base of the government in Saigon with the new prime minister and the new ministers that have taken place. In other words, we have been providing at this time a shield behind which we are helping the South Vietnamese to the best of our ability to build their own political institutions, to improve their military establishment for their own self-defense, and hopefully to develop their economy, all of which has as its purpose their own self-reliance so that we can systematically reduce our input, our effort. I think it would be a very, very wise thing that when and if we see that we can reduce our commitments in Vietnam, which are costly, that we ask that same Congress and the American public to pledge those resources to the great social needs here at home. And I believe that we ought to take a good hard look at it right away, because the surtax, gentlemen, that was put on passed yesterday is a tax for a year, and it can come off. It has an automatic end date, or a date that it ends. I believe that we need to be thinking now of the kind of revenues that we're going to be needing for our urban and other, not just urban, but our economic, urban, and educational health necessities.
You don't mind talking politics, do you?
No, I'd be happy to talk some politics.
All right, let's talk politics. There's supposed to have been a moratorium in the last few weeks until you made your speech at the press club.
Say, may I, before we talk politics, I have a feeling that I didn't round out something. As long as we're on the record, I want to
go ahead.
The whole quest for a stable world, or a more stable world, is been so frequently in recent days tied in with the struggle in Vietnam that I'm afraid that we've lost the balanced appraisal that we need. There are so many emotions that are have been generated by the struggle in Vietnam that the kind of prolonged, intelligent, thoughtful discussion on the building blocks of peace, or the many facets of peace and peaceful construction, have not been given adequate attention. For example, with all of the trouble in Vietnam, for the first time we are getting in Asia a recognition of regional cooperation. I see the Asia of 10 years from now, a few years from now, with principal powers like Japan and India, Indonesia, Australia, and others, not under an American guide or under an American arm or hand, but building their own consensus for their own security, in which we encourage that rather than to direct it. I believe this is what we mean by understanding the geopolitics of Asia. The importance of Japan, the importance of India, the importance of Indonesia, the relationship of Australia and Japan to this subcontinent area, our relationships with China, which I have directed my attention to on other occasions. I think we must have a constant, persistent effort to open up China, to get away from the isolation of China to an engagement with her, so to speak, a peaceful engagement, or at least a policy of containment, as the so that she doesn't become aggressive and expansive, but at least that she has contact, and that we pursue that. Now, I don't think it'll work right away, but I think we've got to pursue it. In trade, I don't mean just cultural exchanges. I don't mean just journalist exchanges and doctors and educators. I mean commerce. Most all political developments follow functional activities. I say so, yes, very definitely to China.
Now, what about the embargo, sir?
What?
What about our embargo, sir?
I think that this is not serving our national interest. I think that on strategic goods, that is military goods, yes, so you must have an embargo. But to embargo, for example, the sale of foodstuffs or soft goods is no longer relevant to the kind of a world in which we live, because we're acting almost foolish. We stand here alone while everybody else around us has a different policy. After all, effective policies must have some kind of coordination from other friends.
Would you apply this also to Cuba, sir?
I believe that in the instance of Cuba that we would have an obligation to make, to have very, very serious consultations with our OAS allies because of the nature of the Cuban subversion and Cuban guerrilla activity in the Latin American countries, with the oftentimes with the problems that those countries have being seriously aggravated. But again, I think this ought to be examined. I don't think you should just blindly say never. I think you take a look to see, does this serve our national interest? And our national interest is not just our own immediate internal interest, but our relationships with the rest of this hemisphere. Again, on foreign aid, we're suffering a serious defeat in Congress now on foreign aid. That defeat may very well compel us to come to a recognition of something that we should have long ago, in my mind, have seized, namely the more active development of the multilateral approach and a very limited bilateral approach. I think in this instance that Senator Fulbright's efforts have been constructive and helpful and thoughtful. Now, we have done such with the Asian Development Bank, with the Inter-American Development Bank, with the World Bank. But IDA stands, as I recollect now, without the commitment from our country. That's the soft window of the World Bank. The African Development Bank is in its infancy. We've made some approaches to it, which I think are constructive. But the mood of the Congress today is not very conducive to effective foreign aid. If we're going to really be involved in national development abroad, and security and development, then we have to find these new mechanisms that keeps us at arm's length at times from the immediate problem, that we have other instrumentalities to work through so that we don't become individually the world's policeman, the world's banker, the world's conscience, so to speak, that we have a consortium, we have partners that are involved in this, who have to make their input, take their responsibility as well as we, and we establish new institutions, not in our name, but of which we are a constituent member. Now, that's part of what I believe is in the peacekeeping. Now, let's to politics.
Are your associates right in saying you've got enough delegates now to win the nomination?
Well, you know what a perennial optimist I am, Scott Even. I must say that...
Just tell me the answer.
Well, the answers are not quite that simple, you see.
Have you got them or haven't you got them?
I think that if the convention were held today, that we would have them. But the convention is not held today, and there's a long time between now and August. It looks very good. But the man that's been in politics as long as I have, I've been, and have seen as many things happen as I have, shouldn't make too many predictions. But I surely will appreciate any help that you can give.
Mr. Vice President, it is your aim of you and your people, I suppose, to sort the nomination before the convention, if you can, so that everything will be nicely tied up in the time all the rest of us get there. Is that right?
I'd like to feel that when I went to Chicago that there were enough delegates in hand so that we had some degree of security so I could be a serene and pleasant man while I'm there.
What would you feel, sir, about the idea that's been put forward by some of your competitors for this nomination? That an opportunity should be given at the convention for Senator McCarthy and other candidates, if there are others by that time, to speak to have, in effect, a debate in the convention, a bid for support of the various candidates, or a bid for support by the various candidates before the ballot.
Well, my good friend, there is no sort of talk, no shortage of talk or debate in this country. What we fail to generate ourselves, you help. There's really a great deal of discussion, and the delegates are not unaware of who's running and what their views are and whether they like them or whether they don't. But anybody that's a delegate to that convention, all he has to do is ask the chairman of the convention for the right to speak, and he'll be heard. And I can assure you that if he's a contender for the nomination of the presidency, and if he is a delegate to that convention and asks for the right to speak, he'll be heard. And in this instance, both the other senator from Minnesota, Senator McCarthy, and the vice president, who's from Minnesota, are both delegates, and I have a feeling that if anybody else wants to run, that they'll be delegates. I don't think there's any problem about an open convention. I know it does make a nice charge. I've made a few like that myself in the past, saying that the convention is all managed and locked up and so on, which is just a lot of bunk. The convention is not locked up. It's wide open. The nominations will be made, and anybody can be nominated from the floor, and you don't even have to be there to be nominated. Somebody can get up and nominate somebody that didn't even get there.
Well, what kind of an open convention is it, though, Mr. Vice President, if you do have it locked up in advance?
Well, my good friend, American politics is relating to the nomination is to try to get enough delegates to be nominated.
And it makes no difference, for example, in your mind, for you to go out now and try to get Kennedy's delegates, though they were gained against your policy.
Well, a number of the Kennedy delegates would, I think, find reason to, I hope they'd find reason to support Hubert Humphrey. We do not live in the world of absolutes. We live in the world of relativity. This isn't a one-issue business. Robert Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey would have voted together on 98% of the issues. In fact, he was never for unilateral withdrawal. In fact, his last statements on Vietnam were so close to the ones that I was making that I wasn't sure that we'd even be able to have a discussion. This isn't a one-issue party, and it ought never to be. I remember when Adlai Stevenson had as his running mate John Sparkman. And John Sparkman and Adlai Stevenson didn't agree on everything. And I can recall that this newspaper has supported candidates that had a great variance of views between the president and the vice president. I noticed that today that Mark Hatfield says he's for Nixon.
Yeah, what do you think about that?
I think that's their business. I happen to believe that when you're out to try to convince people, you try to get at least 51% of their support. I have supported candidates for office. For example, I am an active proponent of the re-election of Gaylord Nelson and George McGovern from the states of Wisconsin and South Dakota. They both oppose my views on Vietnam, at least part of my views. But I think they're great senators, and I think they're needed in the United States Senate. We don't want a Senate of unanimity. We don't want a government of unanimity. We'd like to have a government of some responsible balance. I think these men serve a very vital function in the Senate of the United States, a very vital purpose. So I'm going to go out and try to get as many of the delegates of Robert Kennedy. Many of them supported him because they liked him as a person. Many of them supported him because they thought he would be a winner. Many people support me because of that. They don't all agree with my policies. I have a number of people supporting me that do not agree with all the stands that I have taken. I'm sure of that.
Could you concede, Mr. Vice President, of a Humphrey McCarthy ticket?
I don't think that it would be of any help for me to try to put together a ticket here. I have worked with Senator McCarthy all my political life. If he's the nominee of our party, he'll have my support. Now, let me just make that crystal clear. I think he has enough differences between himself and what the Republican nominee or party would stand for. And besides that, I'm a Democrat, and I believe in some stand for the institutions of our political structure. I think there's enough differences between Senator McCarthy and whom I think will be the nominee of the Republican Party, so that at least he'd have my support. I don't think the Democratic Party is a Humphrey Party or a McCarthy Party or a Johnson Party. I think it is the Democratic Party with a number of views within it. I hope its platform will be a progressive, forward-looking platform, not a recitation of the yesterdays, but a proposal, an agenda for the tomorrows. I'm going to do my best to make it that way, and that's the kind of a man I am.
Mr. Vice President, there's so many presidential candidates from Minnesota. Stassen, the disease.
Well, Stassen moved. this is off the record now. The president has said that when Walter Heller and Orville Freeman and Hubert Humphrey would get him into a little trouble by our propensity to articulate a little too often, he said, "You fellows," he says, "it's the water you fellows drink out there in Minnesota." But I really believe that the political ferment of our state, which is an issue-oriented political structure, tends to breed a kind of political person that has a variance of views and states them. We've always had that in our party. We've had, at the best days in the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota, we would be split at least two or three ways. Here's a man over here that managed the campaign of Estes Kefauver against Adlai Stevenson, Mr. Robert Short, and successfully, and beat the establishment. Now, a little later on, Estes Kefauver became the vice presidential nominee with Adlai Stevenson, and that didn't upset me at all.
How do you think the vice president ought to be picked, the candidate for vice president? Ought he to be a pawn in a political maneuver, or ought he be picked in order to make a good president?
If you will permit me to have those votes before I go to the convention, or at least on the second or third ballot, or first or second or third ballot to have those votes, then we wouldn't even have to consider the implications of your question. You see, one of the advantages of upgrading, one of the ways to upgrade the politics of the country is to have that kind of strength so that you can choose the best. And now in seriousness to you, with modern communication, television, radio, the sweep of our press services and all, region, religion, race, all these things have less significance. I'm not saying they're insignificant. They have less significance. And I believe that the highest standard, the priority standard, is the man's experience, what you believe to be his competence, his capacity to fulfill the duties of the highest office of the land, if need be, his loyalty, and his basic understanding, his basic agreement in philosophy. Okay. I would hope that we wouldn't have to get into a situation in the Democratic Party where the presidential candidate was of one persuasion on the issues, and another man was of a different persuasion. Now, that has happened many, many, many times. After all, Franklin Roosevelt reached down to get John Nance Garner. Franklin Roosevelt was a great president. Woodrow Wilson didn't always take a person with him that was of the same persuasion. And I guess it's fair to say that when Dwight Eisenhower took Richard Nixon, they weren't quite sure that they were of the same political philosophy or persuasion. And I don't recall that you were particularly disturbed about it. But and I don't believe that you were particularly unhappy, may I say, that Eisenhower had the nomination pretty well locked up before he went to the convention.
He's a wicked man.
On the question of your appeal to the Kennedy delegates and the choice of vice president, you said yesterday, I believe, that you hadn't seen Senator Edward Kennedy, and it would have been inappropriate, at least up to this point, to have seen him. Do you have any plans for meeting him? And may I ask a second question in that connection? Does he meet your qualifications for vice presidential nomination?
Answering question number one, I have not seen Ted Kennedy. I would hope that I would in the not too distant future. I most likely see him over to the Senate, which is what has happened in the past. For example, when he'd come back from some of the campaign tours, he'd stop in my office or I would run into him. We're good friends. We have been, as I said yesterday, for some time. Both Ted and Joan are friends of ours. I like them. I think he's able. I think he has genuinely good qualities of both personal integrity and political understanding. I'm not going to go around making any choices. I have not offered this nomination to anybody simply because I don't even have my own. And what is more, I think it's a little cheap to run around and having people say, well, you know, I think Humphrey has been talking about the vice presidency of this man or that man. I can say before any audience and any group of people that I have not talked to a single person in the United States about whether or not he would be my vice presidential running mate if I got the nomination. Now, there will be a time when I need to do that, but I thought it seemed a little bit arrogant on my part and very inappropriate. Let me just say that there are several people that I know that would add great strength to a ticket, and I think do great honor to the office. And I am not going to I'm not going to state their names.
One political question, if I may. Do you think that the President Johnson, is definitely, finally, and irrevocably out of this campaign? And if he should not be and should re-enter, would you withdraw?
I think the President is out. I took him at his word. I've never had a doubt for a single minute that he was out. I'm more sure he's out now than I ever was. So I don't think I need to answer the other question.
Are you troubled at all, Mr. Vice President, by the fact that your old allies seem to be opposing you, many of them, in this campaign, and that your old enemies of the 40s and 50s seem to be supporting you? Does this bother you when you're booed at a poverty rally? That's never happened to you in your life before.
Well, the booing wasn't quite as loud as it had been expressed, but there was some boos. And no one likes to be booed. But I think I know where they came from. And I regret that those things happened, and I regret that some of the violence has taken place, which I think does a great disservice to the cause that the poor people are trying to espouse. I know that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is today having serious troubles with some of the militants that have moved in on them. They are having a very difficult time to be able to have any semblance of order. I think you know that I have tried to respond to their legitimate requests. I'm deeply concerned about the poor of this country and about the needy. I went to their village. I have openly tried to be helpful to those whom I thought were nonviolent and were the sensible leaders. But to get a little booing sometimes is even a compliment, Scotty, if it comes from certain people. I don't feel happy when old friends leave me, either socially or politically. But there are times that there is a parting of the ways. Sometimes it's because of your stand on principle. Sometimes it's because of the situation in which you find yourself. Sometimes it's a combination of both. And if it happens, it happens. But I've learned something else, that when you come down to what they call the crunch, and the date of decision in this country is in November, not the 21st of June or the 23rd or the 25th or whatever day it may be, but it's in November. And I believe then that a number of my old friends that have had some concerns about me and have been a bit unhappy with me, some more so than others, will have to make a decision like most of us do, between two alternatives, or three alternatives. And they'll, many of them, I think, come to support me, just as I would come to support them.
What are you going to do about the young and on the university campuses and your old friends among the teachers?
I have many of them that are my close friends today. I feel very badly when I find young people that do not recall or do not know of my efforts over the years. But that's not their fault, that's mine. I undoubtedly haven't been able to adequately communicate with some of them. But I have been to 102 colleges and universities since I have been Vice President of the United States and since I ran for the office, including the campaign of 1964. I have talked to hundreds of thousands of university students, and if it's not immodest, permit me to say that I have had a royal welcome. Most of the news has been, as you would expect, of the few that have jeered or sneered or walked out. But for every 50 that walked out, 5,000 stayed. And I have not gone to make prepared speeches. I have placed myself before them as a man to be questioned, a public official that makes himself open and available to the inquiring mind of the young. And I have given them honest and forthright answers, and your reporters, any of them that have followed me, have found that they had standing ovations on many times. And I don't think we've lost the young, and what's more is I don't intend to, because you need the young. You can't govern this country in the days ahead unless you have these young people with you, and I want the intellectual community with me. They're the thought leaders. They have a disproportionate influence, and rightly so. And I believe that when they sense the direction that we are taking, and many of them know me now and are solidly with me. For everyone that's opposed or stands aside, I think I can say with some candor, a dozen or more will stand with us. We're today, I have some 30 task forces that work right now on vital issues, great issues, international monetary policy, problems of transportation, problems of even of recreation. How do we develop the recreational facilities of our urban centers? Everything from even the establishment of a new unit of a forest service, in the forest service for our cities. Problems of fiscal policy. 30 task force, 20 of them already fully staffed with the best brains that this country has to offer. Now, I'm not going to list them all out, because the minute that you started, somebody says, well, that fellow is a hardliner, that one's a softliner, or something else. But we have many people coming with us that think enough of their country to want to offer us advice and counsel. George Ball called together here the last time I was in New York, 14 of the best experts of the Far East. And I spent 2 or 3 hours with them. Not long ago, I think it was written up in your press, I spent a whole afternoon at Brookings Institute on the subject of after Vietnam. I have some of the very best people working with me on this. Walter Heller is doing a study with a group of people, just as one, on this. I want this community. I want to merit it, Scotty, not just get it. I want to earn it. And I think I can.
But Mr. Vice President, along this line, these primaries, justly or unjustly, one issue primaries or not, have shown, seem to show a tremendous sentiment against the administration. And since the President took himself out, this is part of this has been anti-Humphrey sentiment. Mm-hmm. I know you have impressive support, but isn't this really your biggest problem, or won't it be if you're nominated between the convention and the election to try to win back these people who seem to be alienated from
Well, I'm not unaware of the significance of the primaries and the fact that a number of people have, in those primaries, as they've been added up, apparently cast their votes not so much against the administration as they have one way or another, because there's one of the other candidates, because there hasn't been an administration candidate on those on that ticket. That's no fault of mine. The president didn't consult with me as to when he was going to withdraw. But let me say this. I've watched the public opinion polls, and they're not rigged. And every week since April, there's been a steady line that Hubert H. Humphrey, this man talking to you, starting quite low, has come on up until in the last public opinion poll, which was also verified after the tragic assassination, that the Vice President of the United States was leading Richard Nixon by 6 points and leading Governor Rockefeller by 3 points. Now, I don't know whether those polls will remain steady like that, but that's been the trend up to now. And if you don't mind my saying, I think that those national polls may be more indicative of the national will and the national spirit than a primary election, which frequently brings out a very small percentage of the eligible voters. And I don't minimize the psychological importance of a primary. But quite frankly, I haven't been in any primary. And quite frankly, I have not only not been in any, I have tried, even when people have attempted to inject my name into it, to keep it out. Because I didn't think that you run very well in the, I don't think you run very well in the primary under somebody else's name, or by a handful of people that say they're going to have write-ins, or by somebody just going around saying, you know, I'm a Humphrey delegate, and hopefully that he's going to meet enough people. Now, here in the city of New York, we closed down our operations totally. And I did so because I was the front runner in the polls, and Robert Kennedy had been assassinated. This was his state. He was the senator from this state, and I had enough respect for his followers and him, and he, the senator, to cut out my operation, stopped all funding, everything. My delegates were mighty unhappy. I can tell you they didn't like it a bit. But I said, look, I'm not going to get involved in it. Now, don't misunderstand me. I do not want to detract from the victories that others have had. But quite frankly, those victories have been very, very modest. And I think that when I get around the country, I sense a very good feeling. I can tell you that we have had no difficulty around this country. In fact, Mrs. Humphrey and myself, or myself traveling individually, we've had the most cordial, warm, and enthusiastic reception that a man could ever hope to have. Now, let me just say one other thing about these task force. We're going to announce them as Thursday,
yes,
some of them.
Yeah.
And you'll find, I think, people that will be, that will impress all of you as being good people. I can't say that every one of them is solely in agreement with me, but they're working to help us prepare ourselves for the task, not only of winning an election, but of being able to present in the election seriously the great issues as we see them. I think an election ought to be also an education period. I want to win, don't misunderstand me. But I do think that this is where you prepare the public opinion for what you hope to be able to deliver if you get elected. And I want the task forces also as guidance for the day that when I'm elected, I must be prepared to take over the reins of this government. I've made some innovative proposals, and I'm going to make many more. I've discussed the easing of East-West tensions. I've opened some discussion on the Asian policy, and more will come, because I do not want to get transfixed with just the abscess of Vietnam. I want to take a look at the whole body politic of Asia and its relationship to the rest of the world. And I shall be speaking hopefully intelligently about that, at least provocatively. I have talked about, at the Coast Guard Academy, the gap between the rich and the poor of the nations, and presented 10 proposals that I thought made some sense. I have discussed the presidency, and there will be more discussion about it. In fact, I noted something in one of your editorials once about it, so I told one of my staff, and I said, just bring along a few things that we've written and said about the presidency. Well, I didn't take exception to it. Look, I'm a man in public life. I know I'm open to criticism. The office of the presidency is not merely a subject of my politics. It's a subject of my profession in terms of political science and study and guidance through my life. I have taught something about these things, not as late, not recently, but at least at one time in my life. I proposed a Marshall Plan for our cities. I shall detail that. The kind of financing that it'll take. The development of an urban rehabilitation and redevelopment bank for America, both public and private financing. the application of principles that we use in our foreign aid to our inner cities, which are as foreign to much of America as foreign countries. I have been the cabinet counselor and cabinet coordinator for a year on entrepreneurship in the ghettos. We're ready to launch our program. The only reason I haven't launched it is because I've been a part of the administration, and I have, in a very sense, very honestly waited for the administration to make its own announcement. This, I am vice president, you know. I'm not just a candidate, and I have to be vice president.
Is that going to keep you from talking about mistakes that you think this administration has committed? One of the tests, rightly or wrongly, that young people and other disaffected people put to you in terms of whether you are looking at this with a new eye is, are you able to see that this or that was wrong, that the Dominican intervention in terms of police action, or this major step in relation to Vietnam was a mistake, and now that I, your country, can step forward as a candidate, I'm willing to recognize.
Well, let me tell you, I consider that the politics, the old politics. And the men who are talking the new politics are practicing the old politics. Because anybody can talk about mistakes. That takes no vision. That takes a mirror. The new politics is the politics of vision, the politics of the future. And you don't need to talk about building a better world by concentrating all of your attention on how people loused up the world that is. I'm not going to spend my time pointing out only mistakes, because if that's the case, then I can take my whole campaign on the mistakes of the Republicans. Every administration has made some mistakes. Undoubtedly have some variance with what's happened both in Congress and in the administration itself. But I think what the people want to know is not whether Hubert Humphrey has a rear view mirror that can point out all the mistakes down that road that we just traveled, but whether or not he has some vision about where we're going, what are the bends and the turns in the road, how can we get to our destination, and what is our destination. I think that's the kind of a president you want, and that's the new politics. It's the new politics of the future, not this old politics of reciting the errors of yesterday. I'm sure we've made mistakes in Vietnam, we've made mistakes in Europe, we've made mistakes in Latin America. I'm confident of it, and if I wanted to prove my intellectual capacity on the basis of mistakes, I could even find some in my own family drugstore or in the New York Times. But that doesn't mean that you really have much vision about either journalism or government.
Well, does this mean that you're going to talk about the mistakes of the past in the Republican Party, but not the mistakes of the past in the Democratic Party?
Well, as a Democrat, you would expect that I would kind of be a little more sympathetic to our achievements. Those are the realities.
Leaving mistakes aside, would you not find yourself inhibited in the discussion of what your attitude is toward Vietnam by virtue of the fact that the Paris negotiations will be going on while you're campaigning, and you are not only a candidate but a member of the administration that is conducting those negotiations?
That's a small price to pay for the success of those negotiations or for their continuity. I would consider it grossly reckless and irresponsible and not in the national interest to jeopardize those Paris discussions. And if it means that I lose a few votes because I don't, that's a price that I'll pay. And I think the sooner that the American people will respect that kind of judgment. That's my view of it. I've been around a little bit, and the people are concerned about peace. And I think the American people are not concerned about trying to prove how wrong somebody was. They'd like to find somebody that can be right. And if I can have some suggestions along the way that might tell you how we can avert other Vietnams, how we can direct the energies of this country to the new priorities and to the new politics, not only of America, but of the world, the new political realities of the world. And they're there. A common market is there. A fractured and broken monolith of communism is there. A revitalized or a resurgent Asia is there. There are all kinds of things that are different. I think the American people want to know, what does a man who wants to be president, what does he know about this world? I'm a good student of history. I never flunked a course. I used to teach it, and I'll let other people practice ancient history. I want to help you make some.
If you're talking, Mr. Vice President, about the state of opinion in this country, and you've had a good chance to see it as you go around. Senator McCarthy, when he was here a week ago, said that he thought that the American public was prepared now to accept a unilateral pullout in Vietnam. If
I'm sure that negotiations will require a great deal of accommodation, and I can't predict what those accommodations will be. But unilateral pullout is not what the American people support.
Let me ask you a personal question. What does Hubert Humphrey, as an individual, think about the accidents of politics and life that have picked you up into a situation you didn't anticipate? What have been your thoughts about all this?
Well, are you asking primarily about the most recent development?
Well, not only that, but the fact that I remember you once said to me that Hubert Humphrey was either going to be president through the deaths of Lyndon Johnson, which you went on to pray would not happen, or if you both lived on to 72, this country would be so sick of both Johnson and Humphrey that there would be no political future. Now, everything has turned around.
Well, I believe, if I may state what I believe I told you, was that I thought that my possibilities of becoming president as the vice president of the United States, with President Johnson being available and to run for re-election, were very remote and most likely would not come unless the president was disabled or unless by some tragedy he was taken from us. I had never contemplated running for president in 1972, and I think I told you that. I felt that as two terms as vice president, you would not only have had a passion for anonymity, you would have been the victim of it. And you would not be able to come out from under it. Plus the fact that after two terms of being a faithful, loyal supporter of an administration, with a man who no longer was going to run after the second term, and with your with the vice president, by the nature of the office, being in a sense in the background, that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, to rise, so to speak, to become a national figure that could attract the voters for the presidency. I have enough difficulty as vice president on one term, and I've been a very active vice president. I have traveled, as I have said here the other day, over 600,000 miles in this country. I've been to 625 cities and meetings in this country. I've been to 50 states, 102 colleges and universities. I've been from one end of this country to another, and I've worked my head off, so to speak, 18 hours a day, and many people say, I don't know where he stands. I must say this is a real new development. Only a few months ago, they said I had more solutions than there were problems, and now some people say I don't have any solutions. They kind of evaporated. But I'm sure that after two terms in the vice presidency, what I told you would have been a fact, Scotty. And I confided in you as a dear friend that I just had no plans. My wife and I have made up our minds, so to speak, that it would be a good time to go back to teaching. Hopefully, I was once thinking of wanting to be a president of the university, but I like a more peaceful life, like being president of the United States.
What were your thoughts at the time then that all this thing changed?
Well, it caught me very much by surprise, even though I'd been forewarned by a few hours. I think you know that on occasion the president had said that he might not run again. I never took him seriously. I feel that most of us get a little downcast and say things to our intimates that we don't always really mean. We mean it at the moment, but we don't really mean it. So I was very perplexed as to what to do. And yet, in a way, I wasn't. I knew that, in a sense, that it was almost a responsibility and a duty. And also, I knew that it was the real fulfillment of a man's political life at my age. At age 57, I feel good. I'm healthy physically, hopefully emotionally, and reasonably alert, I trust, intellectually or in mind and spirit. And this was the right time. If it was ever going to happen, this had to be it. And yet, it's a very difficult decision, particularly when you've been as close to the president and the presidency as I've been. These have been, you really don't just rush into it and clap your hands and say, isn't this great? Isn't it wonderful? Because I have seen the anguish that the president has gone through. I've seen unjust criticism of him. I saw, for example, in the Poor People's March, some 30 speakers, and not one of them ever mentioned a favorable word about a president that has done more for the Negro, more for civil rights, more for the poor than any president, and any, if not any president, at least one of, as much as any other president, and maybe more than most in our nation's history. It kind of makes you wonder if it's, you know, if it's all worth it. But if a man's going to run for president, he ought not to be run because he thinks he's going to be appreciated, or surely that he's going to be loved. He might hope that someday he might be respected. After all, the word president is really, I think Woodrow Wilson once said, the fulfillment of the promise of greatness. And I believe that's about what it means. Wilson wrote some wonderful things about the presidency. So when it came, when Mr. Johnson said that he would not run, that he would not accept the nomination, I had everybody, not everybody, hundreds of people calling me. Some of them said you should do it right away. I thought, first of all, if I wanted to, that would be bad manners. Secondly, I wanted to think it through. Thirdly, I wanted to know whether or not I'd really have some support, because I was not unmindful of the views that some people hold about me, nor have I been unmindful of the kind of, well, you get sort of lost as vice president. And even one as articulate as Hubert Humphrey gets somewhat lost as vice president. And I wasn't sure that my political spirit and personality was sufficiently identifiable so that I could make the run. And this has been, of course, one of the challenges that I've had. But I decided after about 3 weeks that this was possible, and I think my decision was right. I think we've made steady progress. I hope to continue to make it. I believe that I can do it.
Great. Come back again.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you.
Thank you indeed, Mr. Scott.
Yes, sir. Say, we're off to Minnesota, are we?
Oh, we've
got to stop. All right.
I don't think you have to worry about your syntax. Well, you're not worried about this, are you?
Well, we take a look at it just to make sure. We won't be getting any.
What do you mean? You're sending down your office with a couple of friends, and it's hard to get the audio to the files. No, it's not necessary.
Well, that's what I
thought. I don't think they should print
tomorrow. Yeah, we'll get it.
Are you getting it before then?
You might be able to get it before you leave town.
We can get into the discussion. But I think what you're seeing is the impact of mass communication on public opinion.
Pierre, 1960, when was the Cuban crisis?
62.
You could be sitting here right in 62 talking about the missiles in Cuba and Keating telling Kennedy, and you were press secretary, and you could be saying everything then that you're saying now.
Well, I think it was entirely different, because I think we had a president at that time who inspired confidence in the people.
But his rating was going down like a shot, and he wasn't even getting his program through the Congress. Jesus. Leave the other one going. Forget that tape. We'll fix it. We'll edit it later.
His popularity was down, but it's a relative matter. His popularity never got down below 56%, which is pretty good.
I thought there were times it went below.
Never went below 50%. And again, that's another rather. It's not a particularly accurate way to measure sentiment of people anyway, because as I recall, the highest percentage that John Kennedy ever got was 83%, which was the week after the Bay of Pigs, which was his greatest disaster. So when I'm talking about Lyndon Johnson, I'm not talking about in terms of the Gallup poll, because I don't pay much attention to the Gallup poll or those polls. I'm talking about the reaction of people. And I mean, you have to, and when you're in politics, you have to give a certain amount of credence to your own senses and talking to people. And I detect this now. I said 6 weeks ago, I said that Gene McCarthy would get 40% of the vote in New Hampshire. The only reason I said it is anybody would get 40% of the vote in New Hampshire. If I'd run against Johnson in New Hampshire, I would have gotten 40%, because that's a latent feeling
of protest
against him today. Well, he got 42%, which is a lot of protest. He got more votes in New Hampshire than Johnson. So I think that there is a mass discontent with the president.
One last question, and that is this. We touched on it in the beginning. Senator McCarthy is not going to give way. You know that.
I don't expect him to.
Well, where does this leave Bobby?
Well, that's what, as I say, that's what I started out by,
yeah,
by saying. That's what makes the decision very difficult. Personally, I think that there should be an entente between the two of them. I think that there are clearly...
What are they going to do, flip a coin?
No, but I think that there are clearly states where Senator Kennedy would run better than Senator McCarthy, and there are clearly states where Senator McCarthy would run better than Senator Kennedy.
Well, fine, but they go to the convention with 300 votes apiece. What then?
Well, I think if they have enough votes to prevent the nomination of President Johnson, then let the convention decide. But I think that clearly in Wisconsin that Senator McCarthy would be helped by Senator Kennedy campaigning for him. It's also clear from the polls that I've seen that Senator Kennedy would win the California primary by an overwhelming majority, and Senator McCarthy would lose it by an overwhelming majority. Well, I hate to see 174 convention votes go down the drain. And I think that that's part of the thinking in Senator Kennedy's thoughts when he's thinking of running.
In other words, Pierre Salinger, what you're suggesting is that they work together, each winning the states that they can, and then go to the convention and slug it out.
I think that they each ought to try to capture the states that they can win. I think that other Democrats who are opposed to President Johnson can try to hold their own state delegations back from the president and build a block of votes which would prevent the nomination of Lyndon Johnson, and then let the convention decide on who's going to represent the party in the election.
In other words, it's your feeling that the first thing to do is to stop Johnson at all costs.
That's correct.
Pierre Salinger, thank you very much for talking with us tonight. I guess I won't be seeing you till the floor of the convention in 1968 in Chicago again.
I'll be there. Maybe we'll
I'm
all be
sure
surrounded.
You will. Thanks very much for coming by. I know how busy you are. We'll all be watching around the country to see your opening television show, which is called what?
Called With Pierre Salinger.
With Pierre Salinger.
Good, good, modest name.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.